Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the President's proposals today to stop Wall Street speculation, which is driving up the price of gasoline as much as 40%. Michael Greenberger, the former Director of Trading and Markets at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, who have oversight over trading commodities, joins us to discuss whether these proposals, assuming they're enacted, will stop the gouging at the pump by Wall Street predators and parasites. Then we will assess the recent summit of the Americas in Colombia that was upstaged by a minor scandal involving Obama's Secret Service detail that the conservative media have been trying to tie to the president and milk for all it's worth. We will get a critique on what actually transpired amongst the hemisphere's leaders and how much the U.S. is being left behind. Elizabeth Dickinson, who writes the underreported column for the World Affairs Journal, where she has an article, "At the Summit of the Americas, Washington Looks Behind the Times," joins us. Then finally, we are joined in the studio by UCLA historian James Gelvin, an expert on Syria and the Middle East, who has a new book, The Arab Uprising, What Everyone Needs to Know. We will discuss the misreading and misunderstanding of the so-called Arab Spring that is prevalent in the West and the media, and the various revolutions in the region, and get a sobering briefing on the future of Syria. Joining us now is Professor Michael Greenberger. He's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland and a professor of law, professor at the School of Law, where he teaches constitutional law in a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives. In 1999, Professor Greenberger became counsel to the United States Attorney General, and after that, the Justice Department's principal deputy associate attorney general. In 1997, Professor Greenberger became the director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Future Trading Commission with responsibility for supervising exchange-traded futures and derivatives. He also served on the steering committee of the President's Working Group on Financial Markets and as a member of the International Organization of Securities Commission's Hedge Fund Task Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Professor Michael Greenberger.
Good to talk to you again.
And it does feel like the President finally sort of stepped up to the podium and got ahead of this issue over the price of gas. He's being hammered for months now by the Republicans, blaming everything on the president, except the real issue, which is speculation on Wall Street. And finally, the president has addressed that.
Yes, that's right. As I've mentioned to you before, the president has actually been pretty good on this issue when he was campaigning in June of 2008, and oil was at a world record high. He called out speculation, said it should be stopped. On April 21st, 2011, when the oil had reached 110, he called for an investigation of market manipulation to be led by the Attorney General. He reconstituted that task force again in March of 2012, but today he really made it a centerpiece of his thinking on this issue and has called for putting more cops on the beat, as he said. He analogized this to the Enron manipulation of the electricity market in 1999 and 2000 with regard to the West Coast, and I think he is really very much on target for where he wants to go on this issue.
So having worked in the Clinton administration, Clinton was always pretty fast on his feet. You think that the president has met this challenge? Because some time ago, John Boehner, the Republican House leader, said this is our issue, and they've clearly been hammering him at it with all of this drill baby drill stuff that's completely irrelevant.
Senate Minority Leader McConnell today said, oh, this will poll well, but it's a political move. The Republicans right now will not be supportive of this common sense set of proposals, but I think they endanger themselves. This is not taking a position that we need drilling when the U.S. is a net exporter of oil. And anybody who's in these markets will tell you we have tons of oil in reserve that we're not using. This is clearly a market that's been supported by gambling, nothing more, nothing less, and sending false demand signals to the market. So I think the president has begun to get on top of this issue, but I think there are certain actions that can be taken even short of legislation. And I'm hoping that the president, by bringing up some of the key actors in his administration today and having them stand by his side, is sending a message to them as well to get moving on this issue ASAP.
So, again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of markets and trading at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, about the president's announcements today, where he singled out oil market manipulation and called for penalties. The kind of money that he's asking for, $52 million, of course, is a drop in the bucket.
It's a drop in the bucket. You're absolutely right.
The Republicans aren't going to cooperate. I mean, look what happened with the Buffett rule. It lasted a few minutes in the Senate. I mean, they are slapping this stuff down.
I think, well, that clearly is a big danger here, that the Republicans will be obstructive. But in terms of this blaming the president for not drilling enough when the U.S. is a net exporter of oil, the Saudis have agreed to do further exploration and development to the tune of 25% of their present production. Nothing seems to answer this question from a supply-demand side perspective, and it will only be, there's just massive, $500 billion of gambling going on in this market that's essentially sending false demand signals to the market that don't really reflect the fact that we're awash in oil. And the president has at least set down a marker that answers the drill, baby, drill simplicity that the Republicans have pushed on the American nation.
So what's working, though? Drill, baby, drill, or you're being gouged by these predators and parasites on Wall Street?
I think that the experience has been in the summer of 2008, when oil went up to $147, we're somewhere around $105 now. So there's a long way to go to the world record. But when it hit the world record in 2008, the American public really came to the conclusion, which I think they'll come to very quickly again, that this is all driven by Wall Street speculation and not by a failure of production. You don't hear ExxonMobil screaming for more production. They really can't do more production. They're closing down facilities rather than opening them up. There's enough oil to go around here. The CEO of ExxonMobil in April of 2011, when oil was at 110, said the price should be between 60 and 70. They know that they're along for a ride here, that the speculators have given them, giving them that $40 premium here. That's money in their pocket, but it's money they know they don't deserve.
So, Michael Greenberger, there is, of course, a tremendous political subtext here. Where if Boehner is saying this is our best issue to beat the president up on, and Romney is jumping on the bandwagon, criticizing the president for our problems with the price of oil and the availability of oil, and when in fact we all know what's really, or at least 40% of the problem is self-generated, a self-inflicted wound from oil speculation on Wall Street, where they trade paper barrels back and forth, and the Saudi oil minister just only a week ago said that the price of oil has no bearing on rationality and reality. There's an oversupply.
There's two ways about it. I think one of the hidden subtexts of the president's speech today that could promise not only the fact that he's on the right side of this issue, but afford the nation actual relief, is he has now, for the third time, called upon the Attorney General to investigate market manipulation, which can be done. He's asked for higher penalties, but you can put people in jail under existing law. He's asked for 10 years. You can put him in jail for 6 years right now. And the Attorney General, for one reason or another, has just been reluctant to move on this investigation. Ironically, unlike Attorney General Ashcroft in 2001, 2002, who assembled a really powerful investigative task force to go after Enron, this attorney general has been shockingly passive. And I think the fact that the president had him at his side and the two market experts at his side today, the chairman of the CFTC and the chairman of the FTC, may have been an internal message to his own administration to get moving on this issue. There's no doubt in my mind that if the attorney general called in the FBI, had subpoenas issued, interviewed market participants, that the speculators would see that this is not a slap on the wrist issue, this is spending time in prison issue, and I feel, and many of my colleagues feel, the price of oil would go down right away. The problem right now is, and I think the president realizes this, that investigation that he first called for in April of 2011 is something of a joke in Washington. And so I think seeing Attorney General Holder, Chairman Gensler, and Leibowitz there, that may have been the most important thing that happened today. That's not something that the media has picked up on. But for those of us who know the laxity of that investigation, we are all hoping this is Obama's way of making it clear that he has now three times asked for this investigation, and the investigation had better get started in a serious fashion. And that could bring relief within a matter of months.
Well, he does have that sort of political sword of Damocles hanging over him, doesn't he, the president, that if gasoline gets to, apparently his political advisors have told him that if gas gets to $5 a gallon, his re-election bid is out the window.
And there's no two ways about that.
And in front of Holder, he said he wants to put more cops on the beat and raise the minimum fine to $10 million from $1 million for violations. I mean, it's the big banks that are doing this, right, through the Goldman Sachs Index. I mean, that's the
part. It's the Goldman Sachs Index, the Morgan Stanley Index, that's taking in hundreds of billions of dollars in bets. And those two banks are offsetting the betting in their casino by going into the futures market, laying off their, hedging their exposure to those bets by buying, as you said, paper oil that's in 10 times in excess of the world supply. And they trade these contracts back and forth so no one ever has to deliver on oil that isn't there, but it sends a false demand signal. And there's no question about it. The president has real exposure here if oil goes up to around $5, which is not out of the question. And really, to protect himself, he's got to get his own administration moving. Maybe it will help, as it has helped on some of these other issues like the Buffett rule, to at least lay down a marker for the election where he would go as opposed to the Republicans. But I think he really, if he could bring the price of oil down by a dollar, and I think that's not far-fetched if there were a serious investigation here, it would enable him, I think, to sort of get through the reelection with a lot of ease and possibly even return the House to Democratic control.
So do you think Michael Greenberger, again, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, do you think that at some point this Wall Street casino led by Goldman Sachs that's driving up the price of oil and has been doing for some time, at what point will they start selling short then? I mean, it doesn't take much to reverse the trajectory, does it?
No, not at all. And you will recall that in July of 2008, I think you and I met and talked about this that month. Well, when it was at 147, Goldman was telling all its bettors it was going to go to 150 by, it was going to go to 200 by December 31st, 2008, and the price was at 30 at December 31st, 2008. It went from 147 to 30 in 6 months. So, yeah, there will be a dip here, and a lot of people will be caught off guard. The question is, when is that going to happen? If we go up to a world record high that brings gas up in the neighborhood of $5, but it doesn't dip until after the election, that is not going to be good for the president.
So you'd think that Holder would understand that. Do you have any idea of why he's been so truculent on, on?
Well, let me just say, I don't know whether it's truculent or some other dysfunction there, but this is consistent with a lot that's going on in the Justice Department. We have not had one indictment on the subprime mortgage meltdown. The president, in his State of the Union message, called for a mortgage fraud task force. Same thing, interagency task force. There's a lot being written about what happened to that task force. When MF Global failed in October, $1.6 billion of customer funds has gone missing. The Justice Department has again indicated that this is morally reprehensible conduct, but they can't see the criminal violation. This is stolen customer funds that the department is standing down on. There's not been an indictment on the BP oil spill situation. So this failure to act like a prosecutor, what we expect from a prosecutor, on important public issues, this is not an isolated event. This is a Justice Department that has been shockingly passive and to the president's detriment and to the Democratic Party's detriment, and opens up arguments to the Republicans and Governor Romney that would not be available. If you put a couple of people in prison for subprime mortgage fraud, for the BP oil spill, for this gas price inquiry, for stealing customer funds, that's the ultimate lesson to Wall Street, and it's the kind of lesson the American people hunger for right now. They know bad things are happening and people are going unpunished, not only going unpunished, but taking home record bonuses.
Well, I thank you so much. I'm afraid to run out of time.
Okay.
But I thank you so much, Professor Michael Greenberger, again.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Again, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Future Trading Commission. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what was really said or discussed at the recent Summit of the Americas in Colombia that's been overshadowed by this bogus Secret Service scandal.
Get from out the road when he get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affects. The 10K, cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all, a double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut, tut, he about to change the price again. And go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums thrilling in fear. And won't stop top billing till he a gazillionaire. Took a Jehovah money for an Arabic Torah. Charged in advance, translated and ignored us, sorta. The border of Bolivia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty. Dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the workload is too heavy to rise up in arms. And if I ran away, I know they'd probably murder my moms.
Okay, listen, Juan Valdez, just get me my product before we chop off your hands for workers' misconduct. I got the power to shoot a copper and not get charged. And it would be sad to see your family in front of a firing squad. So the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Dickinson, who writes the underreported column for the World Affairs Journal. She was previously the projects editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. And prior to that, she worked in West Africa as Nigerian correspondent for The Economist. She has reported from five continents, and her writings appeared in The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The International Herald Tribune, Newsweek International, and The Guardian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Dickinson.
Thanks for having me.
And it's been somewhat embarrassing to watch the coverage of the Summit of Americas that just concluded in Cartagena, Colombia. The entire focus of the American press was on a minor scandal involving Secret Service agents and some military personnel who chiseled a local hooker out of her dues, and that basically overshadowed the agenda. And frankly, it's pretty hard to find anywhere in the media what the summit was about.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, add to that the pictures that came out of Hillary Clinton spending just a few moments of enjoying herself in Cartagena, and it really overshadowed the rest of the summit. As you said, it was really embarrassing. A lot of countries came to the table ready to really talk about real policy questions about the drug war, the global economy, and it seemed as if the United States wasn't quite ready to have those debates.
And this has obviously frustrated the president and I think more importantly, the rest of the participants in this summit.
It did, although I would have to say that I think that the U.S. administration and more broadly the government, not just under Obama, but for the last 10 years, has really contributed to its sort of sense of looking behind the times in Latin America. This is a continent, South America and Central America as well. They're on sort of on the rise. It's an economically ascendant power. They're experiencing a moment of confidence. Well, they've been largely ignored by Washington for the last 10 years while we've been focusing on Iraq and Afghanistan. And in that time, they've grown more self-confident and less willing to listen and take directions from Washington. So in a way, our sort of ignorance about the continent and watching it grow in the last 10 years has really contributed to that alienation.
Well, as you point out in your article, in the underreported column in the World Affairs Journal, Elizabeth Dickinson, at Summit of the Americas, Washington looks behind the times. You mentioned that Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and Peru are looking really good to investors. In particular, Brazil seems to be forging its own path. It's interesting to note that Brazil, even though it's a democracy, has close ties with the United States, only votes with the United States about 25% of the time. So they are definitely forging their own path.
Yeah, nowhere has that been more clear than in foreign policy, particularly with Brazil. Brazil has really sought to become a global player on the international stage as a mediator. For example, they worked with Turkey a while back to try and arrange a nuclear deal with Iran. That was a deal that really quite angered Washington, actually, because it seemed to sideline the major Western powers in such an issue that's of great importance to them, to Washington, as well as the European capitals. Look, Brazil is ready to play a role on the stage, and its economy puts it in that position. Investors in China, investors elsewhere in Latin America, even American private investors are very aware of this and they've woken up to the fact that Latin America is an ascendant power. Politically, I don't think that the United States has quite gotten to that realization yet.
Well, of course, apart from the focus on the hooker scandal, the only soundbite that made it in the television and papers over here was President Obama saying that he wasn't ready to legalize drugs. That's no surprise because the war on drugs lobby is so embedded in the U.S. economy and in the U.S. government. And it basically is an immovable object. He may make some sort of more nuanced or less nuanced statements after he's reelected, assuming he is. But it seems that that's basically been what our relationship's been, particularly with Mexico and Colombia. It's all about drugs. And there's this enormous disconnect between the U.S., which is the customer for the drugs, it's where the demand is, it's where the money comes from. And yet we consider the war as being fought in other countries, and somehow our hands are clean. I mean, that seems to be a pervasive idea, and one would think that this professorial president would, at some point or other, at least give us a teachable moment about our responsibility for the chaos in Mexico and Colombia in terms of being the customers for drugs.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I think that this is really at the heart of the issue that's separating the U.S. from Latin America. For so long, the U.S. has bought the drugs and then given enough aid to sort of fight these conflicts overseas. Well, at this point, Latin America is fed up. The violence is spiraling. They've tried sort of what Washington's ideas about the war on drugs. They haven't worked in many cases. There have been some successes, but the violence particularly is something that's really made a huge impact on the population there and has sparked calls for change. We're at a point, frankly, where I don't think Latin America is going to wait for Washington to change its own policy on the drug war anymore. You have places like Brazil that are very much equipped to tackle the drug war on their own. Brazil, by the way, is also a huge domestic market for drugs. So if they were to pursue an option such as decriminalization, it actually could have a huge market impact. That's something that could happen very, very conceivably without any approval from Washington.
Well, Brazil, of course, have charted their own path in terms of energy independence and ethanol, which I believe at some point soon we're going to be importing their alternative fuels. And plus, they've got massive offshore oil deposits. Is this just the nature now of this new bipolar world, or not this multipolar world, I should say, that we're entering, where there's going to be no hegemon? What's your sense of where the U.S. fits in this? Because in our current presidential campaign, all we hear from both the president and from Mitt Romney is all this jingoism about the American exceptionalism and, you know, you can't write us off, we still dominate the world, etc. It seems somewhat atavistic to me.
Well, make no mistake, America does have a large amount of interest in these places and influence in these places. And I do think that, of course, when Washington comes calling, people listen. And there, we have, you know, a lot of sort of tools in our toolbox to that extent. We have the economic power. We have leverage in international institutions. Some of that's going to change. But, you know, the point remains, if Washington is behind the times on just the way the global economy is evolving, that in and of itself will contribute to it becoming less of an important power. I personally think that, you know, if Washington can stay, sort of abreast of where these countries are and sort of what their own economic needs are and what their priorities are, that will make them more relevant and more likely to be an influential player in debates outside of our own region.
Well, I think, though, within the Western Hemispheric nations themselves, at this just-concluded summit in Colombia, we're talking about the U.S. in terms of its waning influence in the South American continent, or the Americas, I should say. But within the Western Hemispheric nations, you do have clear winners and losers, and I guess Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras are teetering on being failed states because of the war on drugs. And we've mentioned Brazil and Chile and Colombia and Peru as having emerging and robust economies. What about the ones that have been that were shut out? Cuba and I guess Venezuela wasn't shut out, but Cuba and Venezuela, of course, are very close.
Well, here's another area where really there's an increasingly large divide between Latin American countries and the U.S. Over Cuba. Cuba obviously very much has a lot of reforms left to go before it is anywhere near to a democracy or anything that would satisfy the human rights concerns of Washington or frankly any observer. But having said that, it is a reality in Latin America that Cuba is integrated in the region, and it simply is not, it doesn't make sense at the end of the day not to have it at this summit. That's something that the Latin American countries were arguing and that Obama was really pushing back on. Obviously, there are domestic political concerns for Obama on that. Obviously, there are domestic concerns in Latin American countries as well, who see, you know, sort of Washington imperialism as sort of the a relic of that, from the Cold War era, as wanting to keep Cuba out. But all of that is really just a microcosm of this broader issue that Washington has simply ignored Latin America for the last decade. And as so many things have changed, including things in Cuba, we seem not to have changed our policy.
So is there any way that these Western Hemispheric countries can, you know, start flexing their muscle? You were suggesting earlier, and it seems to be an interesting thought, that they may go their own way, particularly on decriminalizing drugs. Any other areas where they could perhaps, you know, teach us something, or at least, you know, break the spell that the U.S. has had over them for some time?
Well, one of the clearest ways that they are already doing so, actually, is economic trade ties, particularly with China and the Pacific. So something that countries such as Chile have done is they've really tried to open up their markets to Asian investors. Chile, for example, has tried to be the bridge between Chinese goods and the rest of Latin America. They've really experienced a large amount of trade investment from that region. And, for example, one of the main investors now in Chilean copper mines, Chile is one of the world's largest sources of copper, are investors from China. So economically, Latin America is very much increasingly connected with the rest of the world, whereas if you look back 5, 10, certainly 15 or 20 years ago, those ties were almost exclusively with the United States.
So just in closing then, Elizabeth Dickinson, do you think that as the, well, the Iraq war has wound down, and of course it's proven to be one of the greatest geopolitical mistakes probably in the history of foreign policy. I recall an Israeli military historian, Martin Van Creewald, described Bush's invasion of Iraq as the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 9 AD. There's certainly no question that Iraq is essentially in the Iranian sphere, and that the pullout of Afghanistan, I think, is probably will go ahead on schedule, if not at an accelerated pace. And there'll be a disaster there, obviously left behind, as is Iraq. But it seems to me that maybe what will happen in the next few years that the U.S. will just sort of start concentrating perhaps more on, they've already indicated a pivot towards Asia. Do you see any possibility of a pivot towards this hemisphere?
I think it is actually inevitable in the long run that that Latin America and the United States and Canada also, frankly, are connected in a way that I think will remain more or less at times. It will ebb and flow. It's maybe in a low point now. I think we'll bounce back. And the reason for that simply is because of the demographics in the United States. We have a huge diaspora in the United States from Latin America, which is essentially a constituency towards policy that, you know, should, in theory, influence policy and the region, care of policy in the region, care that we do have a policy towards Latin America. We're two regions that are very interconnected. No matter how globalized the world gets, there's simply no denying that we are geographically destined to be linked. But there are ways to do that right, and there are ways to do that wrong. And I think in the coming years, Washington's going to have to think really hard about what policies it can have towards this ascendant region, how it can take advantage of the economic opportunities that are presented, how it can manage the political consequences and the political ramifications of a region and countries in that region that are very much politically ascendant. Brazil wants to play its own role. Great. So how can the U.S. work with Brazil to do something? These are questions the U.S. hasn't asked yet, I feel, and will need to in the coming years.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Dickinson.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I was speaking with Elizabeth Dickinson, who writes the underreported column for the World Affairs Journal. She was previously the projects editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. And prior to joining Foreign Policy, she worked in West Africa as Nigeria correspondent for The Economist. She's reported from five continents, and her writings have appeared in The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The International Herald Tribune, Newsweek International, and The Guardian. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Arab uprisings. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of the present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, a History. And his latest book just out is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And the Arab uprisings, of course, are a mixed bag. I think the one thing in common is that the United States, the lone superpower, seems to have little influence over the outcomes, or of course, with the exception of, I suppose, Libya, in as much as the U.S. led the NATO intervention there. But let's start with Egypt, because that was one of the big shoes and the second to drop after Tunisia. And now you see the military, who don't want to cede power, completely basically cancelling almost all of the presidential candidates, disqualifying them, including the one that clearly was going to be the supporter of the military, the so-called torturer-in-chief, Suleiman. What do you make of this sort of atavistic move on the part of the military in Egypt?
Well, I think the military was always very concerned about maintaining its power in Egypt. And that's why it stepped in after only 18 days of Tahrir Square to take power in Egypt, and very, very slowly began the wheels turning to turn that power over to a parliament or to a president. The rumor had it that the military had reached some sort of agreement with the Muslim Brotherhood. The idea being that the Muslim Brotherhood would give the military immunity from prosecution for all the crimes that were committed after the 11th of February when Mubarak left, and would also allow the military to maintain its privileges, its privileged position in the economy. The military owns approximately 50% of manufacturing, for example, in Egypt, according to the IMF. In return, the military would cede power to the Muslim Brotherhood, with the understanding, of course, that they would go to the barracks, but that could be temporary. It appears that nothing of the sort has happened, however, since that time, and that we're looking at now a showdown that is imminent.
And the notion that the Muslim Brotherhood reneged on their agreement not to run a presidential candidate, they clearly will dominate the parliament. What does that say about them? And there's this lingering sense, in at least in the West, and it comes as a result of what happened in Algeria, is that when Islamists are voted in a democratic election, it's one person, one vote, one time. And that was the reason why there was that long civil war in Algeria, because of the feasts essentially wanting to, you know, gain power by democratic means and then maintain power by undemocratic means. Does that in any way apply to Egypt?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, the Algeria situation was a little bit different than that. Fis won the first round of elections. They got approximately half the vote. It was at that point that the military stepped in, canceled the second round of elections, and then Algeria just descended into, I wouldn't call it a civil war, because the majority of Algerians didn't participate. It was the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, versus a group within the military called the Eradicators. You could see what they were all
enormous
about.
Enormous bloodletting went on.
They say up to approximately 100,000 to 150,000 Algerians died. And as a result of that, according to one WikiLeaks cable from the U.S. State Department, the reason why Algeria did not explode again during the Arab Spring was because of the what they call a post-traumatic stress that the society as a whole was feeling after what had occurred in the 1990s. So that was the situation in Algeria. And the one thing that I think your listeners really have to understand is that we're not in that era anymore of the 1980s and the 1990s, when the paradigm for Islamic politics were the small cadre organizations, Leninist organizations that were attempting to take power. They were smashed in the 1980s, 1990s by almost all governments in the region. And what happened in that wake was two things. Number one, the only sort of Islamic organizations that could maintain themselves were Islamic organizations that would work through the system. And they became like Tammany Hall type organizations, like the Muslim Brotherhood. The Salafists at that time had not even entered into politics. They had pretty much renounced their participation in politics, the Egyptian Salafists. So we have that on the one hand. And on the other hand, what we see is this extraordinary expansion of the security apparatus in the Arab world. And it was estimated, for example, on the eve of the Egyptian uprising, that approximately 2 million Egyptians were involved in the security apparatus, all the way from ministry officials down to common snitches and thugs for hire that the government just kept on retainer to create an atmosphere of fear within society. So it was actually, you might want to say that the government won the battle in the 1980s and the 1990s against Islamist groups, but they lost the war. And that war was the bloated security establishments that they established became a focal point for the uprisings that have taken place since 2010.
But those uprisings were engaged by the young, tended to be liberal, somewhat pro-Western secularists. And didn't the Muslim Brotherhood sit it out a little bit?
Well, there's a couple of aspects of that. Number one of the problems that we have in understanding these uprisings that Americans have and that the media has had as well is that we tend to look at all the uprisings through the lens of Tunisia and through the lens of Egypt. And even that is not very accurate. For example, Initially, only the youth wing of the Muslim Brotherhood participated in the January 25th takeover of Tahrir Square. But then by the 28th, the entire Brotherhood had thrown its weight behind it. And over time, the majority of the people in Tahrir Square were Brotherhood members. They weren't the people that we would watch on television who were fluent in English and tech-savvy. There was a very, very broad-ranging coalition. For example, in both Tunisia and in Egypt, it wasn't the youth that turned the tide. It was actually labor that turned the tide. On the 10th of February, a general strike was called throughout all of Egypt. That was the point at which the army said, we can't tolerate this. We have to get rid of Mubarak. So we're looking through this through a lens that, number one, is not a true lens, and number two, it's not applicable to other places other than Egypt and Tunisia. That, for example, it wasn't the youth that went out in, for example, Libya or in Syria. It was actually the parents of the youth that went out, particularly in Syria, in the town of Daraa. In Yemen, the rebellion was actually hijacked at a certain point by those who were the loyal opposition, hijacked away from the youth and labor. And people were focused on Sana'a, but actually Taiz was one of the real important centers of what was going on in Yemen. So what we see is that it wasn't just the secular youth. It wasn't the youth at all in some places, but a very, very broad coalition of the population. And the idea that the rebellions have been hijacked by Islamists, I think, is probably not a good way of looking at it. I think that the Islamists have been hijacked by the rebellions. Mm-hmm. I think that what we have going on right now is that the series of uprisings that have taken place since 1988 that we've virtually ignored in the West for democratic and human rights, starting in the Black October riots in Algeria, the Bahraini Intifada, the Damascus Spring, for example, in 2000 when Bashar al-Assad just took over, the Cedar Revolution in 2005, the Damascus Program Movement in 2005. All these movements also were focused on democratic and human rights. And if we look at Islamic groups as not being something that's separate and aside from what goes on in the general political sphere, we can't help but see that these groups themselves were also involved in these things. For example, the first grouping that called for Mubarak to resign was a grouping called Kefaya, and that grouping consisted of both, well, actually of leftists as well as more middle-of-the-road secularists, as well as people affiliated with the Brotherhood and various Islamic organizations. The same thing with the Damascus Program Movement. The exact same thing was going on. So we've also seen these people, Islamists, participating in campus elections for officers for student government. We've seen them participating in syndicate elections, for journalist syndicates and lawyer syndicates and engineer syndicates as well. So they're very well acquainted with the political process, and they've structured themselves in a way that is more fitting towards participating in the political process than it is for some sort of 1980s, 1990s sort of rebellion.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. He's a specialist on Syria, and his latest book just out is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. So I guess I'm guilty of having this kind of Western suspicion of that democracy is going to be hijacked by theocracy and that theocracy is inevitable. And we do have examples, of course, of theocracy. We have a phony theocracy in Saudi Arabia. It's really a ruling family using religion as a way to keep the people down. At least that's my shorthand version of it. You have a theocracy in Iran, which the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, recently said has basically been hijacked by the military coup since that rigged election. So I take it just in terms of the Egyptian model, you don't think the Muslim Brotherhood is at all about theocracy, that they can coincide, because the Saudis have been pushing them, the Salafists, they've been funding them, and they clearly don't want democracy. So you have peculiar reactionary, you have the Saudi reactionaries on the one hand, and then you have the different reactionaries in Iran on the other hand, both offering up their models.
Yeah, don't get me wrong here. I don't think that there's going to be a very, very smooth road to democracy anywhere in the Middle East. I think that there's a long, long way that we have to go before we'll actually see that sort of thing taking place. But I don't see in the cards Iranian-style takeover by a grouping such as a Muslim Brotherhood or a grouping such as that pretty much anywhere in the Middle East. It's not the sort of – it's not in the cards. You know, what's interesting is that people said, okay, people like me were wrong about the Iranian Revolution and that, you know, Khomeini, we didn't see it coming. We did see it coming. He had written about this stuff for years and years about establishing a vilayet-e-faqih, a rulership of the jurisconsult of the chief judge, actually. So this was on the table and we knew about this stuff. What we didn't foresee was that he would be able to maneuver his way into the leadership position because it was a very, very broad coalition that had taken into the streets against the Shah in 1978-79. So I don't see that taking place any place in the Arab world. But what I do see taking place is a very, very difficult transition what had been years and years, a half century in some places longer, of autocracies to a democratic transition, if it's going to take place at all. The best chance that we actually have is probably Tunisia, but there's real problems taking place in Tunisia as well. There are very, very strong Salafi movement, for example, in Tunisia, and there's been confrontations that have taken place on university campuses in particular between religious elements and more secular elements as well. Now, this is the sort of thing that can divide Tunisian society. So that is not extremely clear what's going to happen in that particular case. And that's probably the best example that we have of a country that might transition into democracy. But one more point on this is the question of the Brotherhood first saying that they were going to run for less than half the seats and then running for as many as they possibly could. And then the Brotherhood saying they weren't going to run for the presidency and then running for the presidency. In Egypt, yes. The Brotherhood is, we tend to give it complete agency in this. When we say the Brotherhood will do this because it's going to do what it says it will do and so on and so forth. These are people like any other politicians, like any other people in the public sphere. They seize their opportunities and they takes them, as the old saying goes, the old Tammany saying goes. And so if they perceive a vacuum, they're going to move into that vacuum. If, for example, they see that it is much better in their interest to work with a broader coalition, they will work with that broader coalition. So it's not that they're always defining the situation that they're in. They're very often defined by the situation they're in.
So in terms of, the Iranian Revolution, of course, even though it caught people by surprise and they managed to get rid of the leftist elements and the progressive elements and really turn the clock back, they've been around for a long time, for decades, and they seem pretty solid at this point. And they seem to have, even though they're very unpopular, but they've successfully quashed the Green Movement. Saudi Arabia, I talked to some of the Saudi opposition, of course, maybe they're wishful thinkers. They indicate that if there is an uprising there, it will be actually quite secular, that because of the oppressive nature of the Wahhabi structures that the royal family used in a way to keep everybody in line, there may be quite a reaction against that. How would you predict a revolution in Saudi Arabia, if indeed you think one's coming?
First of all, I think that the people that you were talking to are very optimistic about what the future holds for Saudi Arabia.
I kind of think that way, too. Yeah.
There is a term that's been bandied about in describing several of these regimes called coup-proofing. These regimes in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, and in Saddam Hussein's Iraq have been able to take extraordinarily unstable states and stabilize them within a authoritarian structure. And they've done this in several ways. Most importantly, what they've done is they've put what's called coup-critical positions in the hands of kin or their own minority group or tribal elements in some cases as well. And then what they do is they outreach into various other members of the community, and then they build multiple security apparatuses, multiple military units, some of which are directly not within the regular command structure, but directly through, for example, the royal family or through, in the case of Syria, Bashar's brother, Maher, who runs the presidential guard. So these have been extraordinarily stable regimes. And the stability, for example, is shown in the what's going on in Syria. Between 1946, when Syria got its independence, and 1970, when Hafez al-Assad took over, there were 10 coups d'etats. There hasn't been one since. And it's very unlikely that Hillary Clinton's prediction that Bashar will be overthrown in a coup d'etat is going to come to fruition at all. I mean, that's incredibly unlikely. In the case of these regimes, what would have to happen is they will either crush the opposition or they will be crushed by the opposition. There's not going to be a Tunisia and Egypt scenario for those regimes, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Algeria could be thrown into that mix as well, Syria, and you know, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, of course, had to be overthrown by an outside invasion. So they're not going to one part of the regime is not going to move against another part of the regime, as happened in Egypt and in Tunisia. And there's not going to be a Yemen or Libya scenario either, where the regimes are going to fragment. These regimes, the people in these regimes, know that they are either going to have to all hang together or they will hang separately. Sure. Their backs against the wall.
But, James Galvin, clearly Syria is at a standoff in the sense that even though the opposition is underarmed, they're going to be well financed by the Saudis. Asymmetrical warfare is such that it can really paralyze a country. So it seems to me a situation where the opposition can't win, but the government can't control the country either totally. And it could go on for a long time. But as it goes on, it seems to me you already have instability in Turkey. Turkey's going to reach a critical mass when there's over 100,000 refugees, something up to 50,000 already, and that's probably a low figure. It's already impacting Iraq, because the Sunni in Iraq, who are the ones that lost the war and are very surly about that, they're on that area border. They're supporting their co-religionists. It's also affecting Jordan. Jordan seems to be the most likely supply route through which the Saudis will be sending their arms and money. So give me, in the last few minutes, give me a sense of how, even though you say there's a kind of stability of brutality in Syria, there's the instability of the area because it is essentially a proxy war between the Saudi and the Gulf and the Iranians, isn't it?
Well, the United States has adopted a position of just watching and waiting, sanction here, sanction there, I mean, that sort of thing, pushing through the United Nations. But what the United States really fears is not that the regime will crush the opposition. What the United States really fears is that the opposition wins and one of two scenarios takes place. Number one, Syria will just fragment into sectarian enclaves, into between Kurds and Arabs and so
right.
on.
It'd be like Somalia with chemical and biological arsenals on the list.
Right.
Really dire scenario.
Right. And even worse than Somalia is, as you pointed out, the neighborhood that Syria is in, the impact that all this would have, for example, on Lebanon, on the Israel border, on the border with Turkey and Iraq. Already there's also problems around the Kurdish question in Syria. So you have that problem. Then the other thing that the United States fears, maybe justifiably, maybe not, is a Syrian Muslim Brotherhood takeover. Now, after Hama, 1982, the massacre that took place in Hama when 10 to 20,000 people were murdered by the regime through shelling of the city, we've pretty much lost Brotherhood is from our radar screens. We really don't know what it is at this point. We don't know how it's shifted, how it might have changed, if at all. So we really don't want, the American policymakers really don't want to see the Brotherhood in power. One other aspect, which is that if central governments lose control over their territory, that is a prime means by which jihadists enter into those territories. And the border, for example, between Syria and Lebanon is one such area. It's already taken place in Yemen. So I think that the American government is very, very fearful that the regime is not going to be able to just end this thing in some manner, in whatever manner it takes. The Kofi Annan thing appears to be pretty much of a non-starter. What the regime looks like it's doing is keeping the level of violence low enough that it won't trigger a Libya-type response on the part of the West or the Arab League. So I don't see that option as working out either.
But do you think, just in closing, do you think that the U.S. must be tempted by the idea that they could strike a blow against Iran, and that the Israelis must be tempted that they could strike a blow against Iran and Hezbollah, their two most lethal enemies?
I think that the one state that is thinking along those lines is Saudi Arabia. I don't think that the United States is looking at it in those lines. I don't think that the Israelis are really looking at it in those lines. There's too many other things that are going on with the United States and the Israelis. We're both too invested in this regime. The Saudis
You're talking about the Assad regime.
The Assad regime, right, exactly.
That may strike our audience as being a little surprising and deeply cynical.
Well, the border with Israel has been quiet since 1973.
Sure. Which is what the Muslim Brotherhood say. They say Assad's working for the Israelis.
Right, know? Right. Yeah. And the Americans, basically, they like the idea of somebody who can keep this hodgepodge, which is Syria, together. But the Saudis have shifted, I think, their foreign policy in the most recent period. What the Saudis have done has been to take a very, very forward position where they have always been shrinking into the background, letting other people take care of it. At this point, they perceive that American power in the Middle East has diminished to such an extent that what they have to do is to take things in hand themselves. Hence, the noises they're making about Syria. Hence, for example, the very strong stand that they took in Bahrain, where they actually invaded the country, and hence the strong stand that they've taken in Yemen as well. And they're also financing various of Islamic parties throughout the region.
Well, we could talk on here quite a bit, and we've run out of time, James Gelbin, but I thank you for your book, The Arab Uprising, What Everyone Needs to Know, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with James Gelbin, Professor of History at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book just out is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by